This is the Irrationally Exuberant. I'm Reed Messerschmidt.
It all began, as things often do, with a gym teacher. In this happy instance, however, the thing started was not body shame, an inferiority complex, or sexual abuse. It was basketball, which, come to think of it, has resulted in many of those things. You get where you're going one way or the other, I suppose. The year was 1890, and the Canadian winter was colder than Nurse Ratchet in a meat cooler. Dr. James Naismith, a physical education professor and instructor at the YMCA, needed an indoor activity to keep his young men fit and occupied until the next thaw. It's no coincidence, incidentally, that Esperanto was created the same year. Television, hula hoops, the internet, board games, and daydreaming had not yet been invented, but grueling manual labor was on the way out, and standing on the corner jingling your pocket change at passing ladies was losing a bit of its luster. Folks were bored as a teenager visiting a nursing home. So the good doctor, clad, as all gym teachers were at the time, in short pants, girdle, burlap tank top, and wooden shoes, sporting a great bushy mustache, drenched in beeswax and curled up at the ends, often shouting eloquently into a giant conic megaphone and slapping a rolled-up newspaper against his thigh, took to inkwell, quill pen, and vellum paper to begin devising a new game, or gentleman's lark, as games were called at the time. He branded it basketball, as early hoops were just peach baskets and matches required a ladderman to retrieve the ball after each point scored. It was inconvenient, but the peaches dumped from the basket served as a coveted prize for the winning squad. One of these laddermen, just a ladder lad at the time really, was an African-American name of Bonasay Regabandon. He watched in disgust from his perch as lanky farm boys in patchwork overalls, covered in scarlet rubella scars and dirt, plodded up and down the makeshift courts with all the grace of a stuck hog in high heels. The ball they were using at the time was nothing more than dried up old bull excrement fashioned into a crude orb. It didn't bounce very well, of course, and games would often go on for several days, ending with a score of 1-0, or when three or more of the members of a squad succumbed to exhaustion and or tuberculosis. Bonasay believed that the game could be better, more elegant and exciting. Basketball was all but dead and forgotten when he finally got his chance to do something about it. Turned out, folks didn't much care to watch white boys run back and forth with a ball of dung for some peaches. He toiled in the back room of Davidson's General Store, developing a new kind of ball made of cat skins. It would be perfectly round and filled with air so as to make consistent bouncing possible. In 1920, his ball was complete. He took it out to the streets of the south side of Chicago, then known as the baddest part of town, to show off his creation. The people were amazed. They had never seen such bouncing outside of a kangaroo boxing match. Each and every one of them wanted a ball of their own, but the neighborhood was running a bit low on cats by this time, and they were all forced to share the one. Soon, the local fellas were dribbling that ball all over town. They'd begun calling it dribbling, of course, on account of it made all the females salivate with sexual desire, so much so that once in a while the saliva would dribble out of their mouths, which was terribly embarrassing. Those fellas would dribble this way and that, to and fro, hither and thither, passing it to one another when their arms got tired. Once they'd gotten their fill of the dribbling, they reckoned it was time to play some basketball, which they were now simply calling basketball. They cleared the broke-down Model Ts from an abandoned lot, strung some chicken wire around the brim of a busted-out hat, they couldn't afford peach baskets, this being something of a black ghetto, and set about creating basketball as we know it today. Those fellas became very good very quickly. They'd alley the oop, dribble between their legs, shoot from outrageous distances, and on occasion, bust out Fonace's old ladder from his ladderman days to give themselves a leg up, so to say, and have a laugh. The original players were Fonace, known by that time as Cat Scratch, because of the cat scratches he was constantly covered in from capturing and skinning so many cats. He was the star of the team, of course. Albert Alley Albertson, he was the alley part of the alley-oop. Opie Oop or Dunk Dunkerson, the oop portion and namesake of the term slam dunk. Finlay Uppers, creator of the layup and master of fundamentals. And Travelin' Charlie Peeble Bryson, the clown prince, who kept everyone in stitches with his outright refusal to obey the rules. Soon, they became the talk of the town, and then the talk of the whole wide Midwest. They played team after team in city after city, winning by upwards of 300 points in most cases. Them farm boys just couldn't compete. At some point, they were spotted by a white gentleman, name of Verrill Duggar, and he signed them to a big-time contract and promised to make their name all over the globe. He named them the Globetrotters on account of that promise and outfitted them in the most beautiful red, white, and blue uniforms you ever saw. He relocated the boys to Harlem since it was a more active basketball market. They said their tearful goodbyes to their mas and pas and brothers and sisters and headed for the Big Apple. Now, it come to turn out that this Duggar character weren't no good, and neither were those contracts, but that's a sad story for another time. Anyways, you can probably imagine how it goes. The Globetrotters were a smash in the Northeast and stepped onto the national stage when they were parodied in a terribly racist sketch on the popular, terribly racist Amos and Andy radio program. They've stayed there ever since. Now, I only tell you all of that so that you can better understand what you came here to get learned about. The Washington Generals. There wasn't a team in all the land that could be called the equal of the Harlem Globetrotters, and the Globetrotters liked it that way as they didn't much cotton to losing. But by 1956, Coach Regabandith, a very old man by this time and de facto owner of the squad after the mysterious, fiery death of Verrill Duggar, needed an opponent that could look good getting trounced. The spectators were growing weary of the lack of suspense, and ticket sales had suffered. He reckoned that if they could find the right team, they wouldn't need other opponents, could just travel around with them. It'd sure save a lot of scheduling hassles. Problem was, there weren't many white teams, which is what most every team was back then, willing to sign up to be beaten by a bunch of black folks day in and day out. Enter Lewis Red Klotz, star player and owner of the Philadelphia Sfaz, a Jewish team in the middling Eastern Basketball League. Klotz was a man of small stature. He stood a mere 4'3" and even smaller feet. Really, his feet were no bigger than a Ken doll's, and he still holds the world record for foot size to vertical jump ratio. But he had a big heart, as they say, not to mention a bucket or two of admiration for Coach Fonese's team and a heap of empathy for the obstacles they often encountered. His band of Hebrews had gained a reputation as the least terrible of all of the non-Globetrotter teams. They defeated every team that had given them a fair shake, but many had not, I'm sorry to say. Anti-Semitism was as rampant as racism at the time. The Christian folks who made up, and still do, I suppose, the general public, so to speak, believed many of the things about the Jews that they now believe about black folks. That they were born with an almost superhuman athleticism, an absence of morality that made them intimidating opponents and feared. That fear made folks angry, and that anger made them stupid and caused them to do mean things. Funny, I guess, how these matters change without changing much. Not ha-ha funny. More peculiar, I suppose. Terrible, really. Anyway, the Sfaz, which stood for South Philadelphia Hebrew Association, were made up of such Semitic superstars as Shaiky Gotthoffer, Mendy Snyder, Mo Goldman, Gil Fitch, the previously mentioned Red Klotz, and their sixth man, the lone Gentile on the team, Ricky Bongiorno. None of these boys had any specialties so flashy as the Harlem fellas, but they were an interesting lot in their own right and could play a fair game of basketball. When Red heard tell that the Globetrotters were looking for a worthy, long-term opponent, he immediately sent a telegram to Harlem offering his team services. Coach Fonese had heard tell of the Sfaz and invited the boys for an exhibition match at the newly built Rucker Park as something of a test run. The game was an overwhelming success. Crowds amassed at the outdoor park, backing up traffic for miles. Businesses were shut down for the day. The final score was 225-78 Harlem. It was the closest anyone had come to beating the Globetrotters. Fonese signed a 1,000-year contract with Red on the spot, on the condition that they change their name, as Sfaz don't make a lick of sense unless you know the acronym, and it's none too easy to say either, with the S immediately preceding the PH. They chose the Washington Generals. No one can say why, though some speculate it's an homage to our country's capital and non-specificity. And the rest is history. Since that day, the Generals have played the Globetrotters well over 20,000 times, and since 1959, lost all but one of those matches. They've humiliated themselves in front of folks of most every race, creed, and station in more than 120 countries. They were named the official mascot of South Dakota and have been the spokesman for dozens of products, including Georgia-Pacific Jumbo Office Bath Tissue, Dynarex Cleansing Disposable Enemas, and Kharkov Vodka. Ralph Nader is a huge fan and can be seen sitting stoically behind the bench at many of their games, hands balled into fists of impotent rage. They're no longer a primarily Jewish team, but a place where men of all faiths and nationalities can euthanize their dreams. They're an American institution, a symbol of Sisyphean toil, pride of the born loser. Many honorable men have worn the green and white jersey, and not a few have left battered and broken, resigned to the futility of life. We'll get to some of those men's stories and more history of the Generals after this brief commercial break.
Attention! The Washington Generals are looking for a few good men. Well, decent men. Men anyway. Or biggish boys. Or women. Anybody at any point on the beautiful rainbow of the gender spectrum will do, really. The Washington Generals are looking for people. If you love basketball and losing, or have just hit rock bottom and have nowhere left to turn, why don't you give us a try? Heck, maybe you hate basketball and want to besmirch its name. This would really be perfect for someone like that. You'll get to meet the Harlem Globetrotters, which is fun, though under no circumstances are you allowed to talk to or even look at them. You'll also get some very meager pay. And travel. You'll get to travel. The 267 games per year schedule is pretty grueling, though, so you'll mostly just be on buses and planes. Really low-rent buses and planes. Sometimes vans or even those station wagons with the seat in the back facing the rear. That can be fun. You can pretend you're traveling backwards through time to a point in your life when you weren't so sad and desperate, and the certainty that you'll be killed if there's an accident is a real adrenaline rush. Perhaps you're a masochist and like being humiliated. There's plenty of that. If any of this sounds remotely tolerable or just preferable to the suicide you have planned, give us a call at 1-800-GENERAL. That's 1-800-436-3725. Or make your way to your local library to send an email to our general manager, John Ferrari, at jferrari@washingtongenerals.com. If you're considering this at all, I assume you can't afford your own computer. Sign up today and we'll throw in a $50 gift certificate to Radio Shack as a signing bonus. So come, join the Washington Generals, where dreams go to die.
This is your Washington Generals All-Century Team! At point guard and head coach from South Philadelphia, standing 4 feet 3 inches, the man who started it all, Lewis Red Clutch!
Klotz was an accomplished basketball player well before forming the Washington Generals. He was one of the top athletes in the American Basketball League in the 1940s, the third shortest player ever to see game time in the pros, and won a championship title with the Baltimore Bullets in 1948. So what drove him to dedicate the greater portion of his life to a team designed to lose every game? It didn't start that way. In the beginning, the Generals were a legitimate foil for the Globetrotters. Matches were on the level, the losses were legitimate. But Coach Fonese wanted to up the antics, make games more of a show, and was pressuring Klotz to dial it back to such a degree that his team couldn't possibly win. To essentially take a dive every night to the extent that the Globetrotters could just goof around and win handily. Klotz resisted at first, citing an allegiance to the spirit of the game and personal pride. In 1958, though, he relented as penitence for killing a man. During an interview with Sports Illustrated shortly before his death in 2014, he confessed to a terrible Benzedrine habit that he picked up in the late 1950s, while making time at jazz joints with Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy. One night, Kerouac asked him about the darkest thing he'd ever done, and Red was humiliated when he couldn't come up with anything. He was a nice Jewish kid, after all. Around 4:15 that morning, pacing back and forth at the Chelsea, mad with speed, he caught a glimpse of a haggard old street bum outside of his window. The rest, he said, is hazy, but the man wound up dead, and Klotz wound up in Cassidy's bathtub, having blood and brains scrubbed from his body and hair. The next day, sobbing and scared, he agreed to Fonacé's terms, essentially dooming the generals to a lifetime of indentured stoogitude. Klotz remained publicly upbeat until his death in 2014 and insisted that his team made an honest effort in every game. In private, though, he was a haunted and broken man and could often be found in his office staring blankly into the abyss, absent-mindedly fondling one of his victim's teeth, which had been extracted from his knuckle by Jack Kerouac on that fateful night.
At center, also from South Philadelphia, standing 6 feet, 3 inches, Shaiky Conover!
Shaiky is another of the original generals. An extraordinarily lanky gentleman, he held only 150 pounds on his 75-inch body. For years, he was the leading scorer on the SFAs and the Generals, averaging 4 points per game, mostly due to his height. He would just stand in front of the basket. This was before lane violations, and the team would lob the ball in his general direction. You'd think this would have resulted in more points, but Shaiky was incredibly uncoordinated. He quit the team 6 months after Red signed the new contract and began doing comedy on the famed Borscht Belt circuit alongside such legends as Shecky Green and Soupy Sales. His jokes were mostly about how difficult it was to be so tall. Deli booths were uncomfortable and outhouses were no picnic either. His most famous joke was this. People ask me, how's the weather up there? I say, not so good. As far as anyone knows, he is still touring, doing the same routine.
At shooting guard from East Gwillimbury, Ontario, standing 5 feet 6 inches, Hardy Chubbs Rodenstock.
Hardy holds the dubious honor of being the heaviest shooting guard ever to play professionally. Professionally, of course, meaning that he was paid the menial salary of a general. He weighed only 160 pounds at the beginning of his career in 1984, but by his untimely passing in 1990, he had gained a staggering 212 pounds. The constant beatdowns and fast food meals on the road added up. Towards the end, he played no defense, just waited at the top of the key, his sweet spot, for the team to come back down the court. But man, when that guy got hot, he was something to behold. He once sunk 27 baskets in a row during practice and probably would have continued the streak if not for an asthmatic fit and subsequent trip to the emergency room. Games were another story, though, as the Globetrotters only let him get the shot off a total of 15 times in his 6 years on the team. Rodenstock passed away after an incident with a murder of crows left him homeless and unable to properly attend to his diabetes.
At power forward from somewhere in Russia, standing 6 feet, 2 inches, Valentin Engelgart.
No one was quite sure of Engelgart's background, as he didn't speak much English, or speak much at all for that matter. He did a lot of throaty mumbling, though. He ended up playing for the Generals when he stumbled upon an old promotional pamphlet in his homeland in 1994, and, assuming they were an NBA franchise, had a friend send a letter in broken English to the address listed there. He was shocked when the reply came 2 months later, telling him to get on a plane. They were in need of a player. When he found out the true nature of his new gig, he was furious and then sullen. He didn't have enough money to get back home. For all anyone knows, he was a tremendous player, but he put forth very little effort, mostly just loping up and down the court looking surly. In 2004, he was deported after the government discovered that he'd not bothered to get a work visa. He's not been heard from since, but by all accounts was thrilled to be sent back where he came from, smiled for the first time in years, and said, quote, "My hate for this country and team and game cannot be overstated, but the nightmare is over, and I am pleased as punch to be headed back to the warm bosom of Mother Russia, where nobody smiles when they are sad."
At small forward from Maskewville, South Carolina, standing 6 feet even, Huntington Ox the Seventh.
Ox comes from a once extravagantly, now only somewhat wealthy family that charts its lineage back to the Mayflower Puritans and beyond. They made their fortune on the slave trade and manufacture of buckled caps, and it dwindled once those caps fell out of fashion and the prospects of the black human beings they exploited improved. By 2009, when Huntington VII joined the generals, they were just wealthy enough to provide him with a monthly allowance of $2,000. So he did what many in this position do. He became an entitled hippie. He had dreadlocks, a gross beard, wore patchwork pants, the whole bit. Ox contacted the team ironically and was surprised to be almost immediately accepted. His career is notable only for the fact that he has played every game under the influence of psilocybin. He is a terrible person and only made this roster because there are very few persons of note in the long, undistinguished sea of white ciphers that make up the history of the generals. Which brings me to our sixth man, a representative of all of those forgotten sad sacks.
And your sixth man from Williston, North Dakota, standing 5 feet 10 inches, Kenny Wickersham.
Wickersham was an above average basketball player in high school and then a below average basketball player at his Division III college. He developed a drinking problem and lived with his parents for a few years. His options, as he saw it, came down to either joining the army, which he was a bit old for, or joining the Washington Generals, which he did. He was fine and is almost completely unremembered after a 14-year career. Currently, he's the manager at an Arby's in Wahpeton, and pathetically, happier than he's ever been.
Washington Generals, I'd like to join your team. I don't play ball, but I do know how to lose and beat me. Washington Generals, you play how I feel. to a game that isn't real. Washington Generals, Washington Generals, Washington Generals, Washington Generals, Washington Generals, Washington Generals, Washington Generals.
Welcome back. I've got a special guest in the Irrationally Exuberant studio today. He was only the second ever Goyish member of the Washington Generals, joining at the ripe old age of 37 in 1959 and playing with the team for a total of 19 years. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor to introduce you to Merrill Figley. Mr. Figley, thank you for joining me here today.
Thank you for having me. I didn't think anybody gave a good goddamn about this godforsaken team.
Well, they don't mostly, but I've always been fascinated by the Washington Generals. I think the team serves as a great example of the futility of following your dreams well past the point where it makes any rational sense to do so. Your thoughts on this?
Huh?
Could you speak into the microphone, please?
What?
Well, let's start at the beginning. You joined the Generals relatively late in life. What were you doing up to that point?
What was I doing? I was a conscientious objector in WW2. This was before such a thing was in fashion, mind you, and such a stance was extremely unpopular. So far as I know, I was the first and only one.
You conscientiously objected to World War II? On what grounds?
Oh, I don't know. That was so long ago. I guess I just couldn't be bothered. See, I didn't much care for reading and keeping up with the news and the like. I was living with my folks at the time and pretty caught up in the Betty Boop craze. Oh, I did love Betty Boop. She was the apple of my eye. Never found a woman the equal of Betty Boop, I can tell you that, son. Those big eyes and that shiny mouth. Sometimes I'd get out the hair jelly and do myself up just like her. Oh, I was fond of Betty Boop, I was. I had a beautiful Betty Boop collection. Betty Boop dolls, Betty Boop tins, Betty Boop statuettes, Betty Boop trading cards, Betty Boop comics, magazines featuring Betty Boop clocks, Betty Boop hats, Betty Boop...
I'm going to stop you there. You were telling me about objecting to World War II.
Huh? Oh, I guess I just didn't want to go. Couldn't stand to be parted from my Betty Boops. And it was comfortable there at my parents' basement. I lived there right up until joining the Generals. When the army came a-looking for me, my folks would just tell them they didn't know where I was, and I'd hide in the closet for a bit. Kinda like that book, you know. Oh, what's it called? It was a diary of a fashion.
The Diary of Anne Frank? I hardly think that's an appropriate comparison, especially for a man who objected to the Great War. You lived with your parents until you were 37?
Well, anyway, it was right nice living there, and I hated to go, but my folks had come on to some hard times, which they unfairly blamed on me. Sold my whole Betty Boop collection when I was at the picture shows. I was hopping mad, I was. I stormed out of the house. Never did see them again.
Wow. I guess it is fair to say that the greatest generation tag doesn't really apply in your case, huh? What did you do then?
I didn't know what to do. I just ambled about for a few hours. Then I heard some folks talking about the welfare, something about how Roosevelt had ruined America, and I asked them where a fella could go to get this welfare. Well, they wouldn't tell me, but eventually somebody did. So I marched right down to that welfare office and demanded a check. They refused, but I noticed a placard in front of the building advertising the Washington Generals. They needed an able-bodied man. I didn't know if my body was able or not, and I'd never played a lick of basketball, but they was paying, and I needed to eat and buy more Betty Boop merchandise. So I snuck back into my folks' house when they weren't home and dialed up the Washington Generals.
And they took you on without any prior basketball experience.
Well, by that time, the team was a laughingstock. The original players had all quit, and most white folks at the time didn't much cotton to being humiliated by Negroes. They'd pretty much take anybody, I guess. I didn't care one way or the other about being humiliated by anybody, black or white. I just needed some scratch so I could get my hands on some Betty Boops. I had my eye on one particularly handsome Betty Boop cookie jar.
Jesus, can we... Tell me about playing with the Generals.
As I mentioned, I couldn't play a lick of basketball. Hardly knew what it was. But old Red taught me everything I needed to know. Oh, he'd get so mad sometimes. Shut the fuck up about Betty Boop, he'd say. But he loved her just as much as anybody, I could tell. Who wouldn't? Those big eyes, that tiny mouth.
God damn it, Merrill. Do you have anything interesting to say about the Washington Generals, or are you just going to keep yammering about fucking Betty Boop?
Oh, I've never had sexual relations with Betty Boop. Not the real one, anyway.
All right, we're done here. Merrill, you are a complete waste of space. Let's go to the tale of the time the Generals beat the Globetrotters and made a bunch of kids cry.
Get out of my house, you old asshole.
...1971 was a bad year for the United States. The dream of the 60s, which, despite what the boomers would have you believe, was mostly to do drugs and fuck a lot while dressed like a whimsical hobo sprite, had died. Richard Nixon was president, the Vietnam War continued, Three Dog Night topped the charts with Joy to the World, closely followed by two songs featuring Osmonds, and the Manson family lost their beloved patriarch to the long, flabby arm of Johnny Law. Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange passed for escapism. It was bleak. There were a few bright spots, oases for the losers and underdogs. Jim Morrison finally died. D.B. Cooper stuck it to the man. Sean Astin, who would go on to play Rudy, a character designed to elicit happy tears and sympathy from boneheads who most certainly would have bullied the kid in real life, was born. Also born that year, Brian Dunkelman, a man who, for one shining moment 25 years later, proved that even the most bland, talentless, and grotesquely monikered among us could co-host a popular television program alongside Ryan Seacrest before being tossed into the Z-list trash pile. And perhaps most importantly, the Washington Generals, often described as the Dunkelman of sports, defeated the Harlem Globetrotters. It was an unlikely victory. Since games between the teams are rigged in Harlem's favor, they can use ladders, for Christ's sake, and for decades has been misreported as a fluke, an off night for the Globetrotters capped off by an unattentive timekeeper. The real story is far more interesting and has finally come to light via the newly discovered diary of Generals legend Red Klotz and confirmed by Trotter star Meadowlark Lemon, who was reached in a seance conducted by renowned psychic, Madame Esperanza Lechuga. This is how it happened. It was October 22nd in a biggish Murfreesboro Civic Center bathroom, which was operating as the Washington Generals locker room. Red Klotz was pissed. He paced the room, slamming stall doors and slapping stand-up johns, shouting curses in Yiddish. Gares, karoks, mumsters, fah! His team sat by uncomfortably, and spectators who had just wandered in to take a piss hurried out to see if the ladies' room was occupied. Red looked terrible. He was clearly hungover, still reeked of bad whiskey and maybe a hint of urine, but that could have just been from the bathroom. His rapidly thinning hair, usually combed over, was mussed, the long hairs on the side bent in wild, backwards arcs over his ears, his eyes swollen a deep, bloody blue, his lips split in two places, the meat of his thighs scratched up beneath backwards short shorts, and his knee-high socks bunched up grotesquely at the ankles. His tiny feet clip-clapped across the linoleum, and he stared with deep revulsion into a mirror for a very long time. He spat blood into the sink. I have had it with these fakakta shtiktas.
They've humiliated me, us, for the last time. Oy, I can't believe I let those motherfuckers do this to me.
He turned to his players.
Bertscab,
he barked at a man sitting on a folding chair between two toilets. Bort Bertscab, the squad's long-suffering power forward. When was the last time you won a game? Bertscab barely looked up.
I never won a game, he muttered. I gave dogs haircuts before this. Bad haircuts. Hammer Dancer, how about you? When's the last time you won anything?
Dwayne Hammer Dancer, a rookie and current excuse for a shooting guard, was terrified.
I've gotten one of those Indians shooting a star on a Tootsie Pop a few times. Never turned him in, though. I'm not sure if that's even really a thing.
You're all pathetic. We're pathetic. Hell, I'm the worst of you. I was a star. I swear to God I'd kill 10 more hobos just to wake up from this goddamn nightmare.
The team looked more confused than ever. Tonight, we are going to beat these sons of bitches. Bertscab spoke up.
Maybe you should splash some cold water on your face, coach, or take a nap. Something. You're in bad shape.
I am fine. Red said. I'm just a little beat up, and I know what we have to do. Either we beat them, or we may as well just end it. The lot of us. This is no way to live.
But we can't beat the Globetrotters, coach,
Haberdancer pleaded meekly. It's our job to lose.
Stoop our job! It can't get any worse than this. Now, you can either help me beat these rat bastards, or you are off the team. The choice is yours.
He stared at them through his swollen eyes. It should have been dramatic, but these were broken men. They mostly just shrugged and went along, as they'd done for their entire lives, neither so opposed as to disagree, nor enthusiastic enough to fully engage.
There's no game plan. The Globetrotters must be in rough shape themselves. Just score as often as you can and get the ball to me whenever possible. I'm old and I'm currently a mess, but I've still got a better shot than any of you sorry sons of bitches.
And so, with no fanfare and only the slightest tremble of butterflies, the Washington Generals exited the bathroom and headed to the court to make basketball history. October 21st, the previous night, had been Red Klotz's 51st birthday. For most of the day, he barely noticed. 51 is an inauspicious holiday for anyone, and Red didn't have any family or real friends to speak of. He didn't even bother to tell his team. Somehow, though, the Globetrotters found out, and since it was a rare day off, they invited him for a night on the town. Meadowlark Lemon himself had approached Red with a toothy, wily grin.
Happy birthday, old-timer. We are gonna have ourselves a party for you tonight. Get yourself straight, and we'll send a ride at 9.
He walked away before Red had a chance to respond, but if he had, he would have casually accepted and felt both giddy and reluctant, which is what he was left with now. He'd been dead sober since that fateful evening 13 years ago and was fearful of what a night out with the Globetrotters, famed drinkers, cokeheads, and womanizers, all of them, would entail. Red was waiting in the Super 8 lobby at 9, nervous and doubtful that they would even come. Dressed in high-waisted press slacks, a starched red shirt tucked in tight, and his tennis shoes, the only shoes he owned. A limousine, gigantic and gaudy, painted in red, white, and blue, pulled up in front of him. A side door opened. Light, smoke, and music, cool in the gangs, live at the sex machine, though Red didn't know this, poured into the night. The grinning face of Meadowlark Lemon slowly emerged from the haze.
Come on in, birthday boy. We are going to have a time.
Red hesitated for a moment, negotiated with his sobriety, and climbed in slowly, coughing and awkward.
Get those tiny-ass feet in here, Lemon shouted over the music, and grab a seat at the head of the class. This is going to be the craziest motherfucking night of your life. We're going to show you how the Globetrotters do it.
Red made his way slowly down the shade carpet aisle of the limousine, hunched over a bit, but not so much as the behemoths in their Trotters warm-up suits sitting to his left and right. They were smoking and drinking, laughing and pawing at the myriad women who Red supposed were ladies of the night. He sat down at the head, his back to the wall separating the debauchery from the driver. There was Corny Musk Train, a blunt in his mouth and his hand a good way up the skirt of a woman wearing a pound of makeup and a gigantic blonde wig. Morris, downtown brown grass, doing lines off a red, white, and blue basketball that he passed among two large, cackling women, spilling out of tiny dresses. And Meadowlark, still grinning at him while two women furiously groped each other and sucked at his neck. Red knew that Pokey Joe Lamar and Alfonso Hot Dog Soup Jefferson were there as well, doing God knows what, but he couldn't see them through the haze. He sat rigid for a good long while, a half smile on his face, hands in his lap. Meadowlark had turned his full attention to the ladies, and none of the others had acknowledged his presence. "This is fine," he thought. "I'll just tag along as a spectator and have some stories to tell the boys in the morning." Then Corny handed him the basketball covered in lines. He shook his head and put his hands up, muttered a no thank you, but Corny fixed his eyes onto Red's, maybe a bit threatening, and he pushed the ball closer. Red took it, hesitantly, and then took the straw. He leaned his head over a rail and took the whole thing into his nose. It felt terrible and then really fucking good, so he did another one and passed it to one of the girls. A joint came his way next, then a bottle of Jack, then Coke again, etc. He still didn't much move, didn't attempt to talk to anyone, and no one was talking to him. But he felt exhilaration for the first time in a very long time. And then they were pulling into a gravel parking lot. The party poured out of the limo, but Red stayed behind, smiling and panting, still awkward and unsure despite his deadened inhibition, until Meadowlark popped his head in to tell him to get his ass out of the car. There was a blinking red neon sign above a haggard Tennessee bar, Two-Eyed Jacks, it said, and the parking lot was filled with pickup trucks. He followed the men into a dim, smoke-filled bar crowded with sad-faced hill people, and the place went dead quiet. A beat-up girl who had been dancing, fully nude, on a small stage at one end of the place dropped down from the pole with a screech of skin on metal. A few racial slurs were uttered and a couple of rednecks looked ready to fight, but then somebody in the back yelled, "It's the goddamn Harlem Globetrotters!" And most of the crowd cheered and laughed. When Meadowlark loudly announced that drinks were on them, most everybody was on board and the party began. The rest of Red's night was drowned in a sea of liquor. He remembered that some of the guys had made a fuss about his feet, had made him take off his shoes and do a little tap on the bar. Normally, this would have enraged him, but he was so overcome by the acknowledgement, the sense of actually being a part of the team that had ignored, humiliated, and defeated him almost every day for the past 14 years, that he happily obliged. The players picked him up like a child, paraded him around. He took shot after shot, made clumsy passes at the girls, laughingly tolerant, but unwilling to disappear with him into the bathroom as they were with the others. Eventually, he went into the bathroom alone, took a long piss, and swayed blurry-eyed in the mirror. "This is how I should be living my life. I'm no fucking loser." He was in there for a very long time. When he came back out, the scene had changed. The bar had returned to a sea of unhappy, intoxicated white faces. There wasn't a Globetrotter to be found. He ran out the front door and into the night just in time to see the limousine peel off. He shouted, "Meadowlark, guys!" A beer can flew out of the moonroof and landed 20 yards in front of him. He began to chase after them, but fell hard after four or five steps. He lay there for a full minute, considering his options. His booze-addled mind wouldn't settle upon anything but anger and shame, so he got up and walked back into the bar. Three men sauntered toward him.
"Looks like your friends done left you. What you get for palling around with those types?" said the tallest of the three.
He was fat and dirty, but his neck revealed a muscled frame.
"How you gonna get home?"
The second man was a slimmer version of the first, likely his brother.
"Lessen you planning on catching a ride with one of us. Why, I'd be happy to give this old Jew a ride. Let's get him in my truck,"
first man rejoined. The third man, huge and unspeaking, grabbed Red's arm and they led him back outside.
"Really, fellas, I'm fine," Red pleaded. "I'm sure they're just joking around. They'll be back any minute."
The first man spoke up again, nose to Red's sweat-dappled forehead.
You saying you only rattle blacks? My truck ain't good enough for you? Look at me, boy.
Red looked up, terrified, and the man spit in his face. He pushed him to the ground and the three men beat the living shit out of him. Red passed out almost immediately. When he woke up, everything hurt, but he could stand. He took stock of his condition, found that his pants were gone, though he was still wearing his shoes. And then he ran, sobbing, unthinking, across the parking lot, through a wheat field, on and on. At some point, while bouncing over train tracks, he blacked out. When he awoke, the sun was rising and he had miraculously made it back to the Super 8. He went in, trudged past the pitying eyes of the manager and to his room where he slept hard until 45 minutes before game time. For the first hour, the game went pretty much like any other, though there was a notable lack of antics and enthusiasm from the Globetrotters, who were also very hungover. When Red walked onto the court, the Trotters stared at him with shock and shame, whispering amongst themselves. The crowd collectively gasped. Metalark Lemon approached him.
Jesus, Red, what the fuck happened to you last night? Maybe you should sit this one out.
Red ignored him and took his position on the court.
Come on, man, we were just having some fun, Lemon yelled after him.
As the game progressed, the fans grew restless. There were boos. The Globetrotters walked through their paces, half-heartedly doing the glitter bucket routine and figure eights, but this was not the uproarious show they'd come to see. The score stayed close, which was not unusual. The teams always kept an air of fair competition. But with 3 seconds left, it was 99-97 Globetrotters, which was unusual. The Trotters had lost track of the clock, and the Generals had the ball, were set up for an inbound pass on the far end of the court. The Globetrotters stared at them with panic and foreboding. The crowd was dead quiet. Red called the timeout. He gathered his men in a huddle.
This is it, boys. This is the only shot any of us will probably ever have to be winners. We spent our lives being demeaned, tossed into the trash can like bloodied up tampons. Probably deserved it, most of us. But a man can't live like that forever. A man can only stand so much humiliation in his life. A man has to stand up every once in a while and remind the world that he is more than the cast-off reminder of a woman's ability to bear children. That he's a human goddamn being. Are you ready to remind them that?
They stared back at him, eyes like the dusty black jelly beans at the bottom of a grandmother's candy dish. Jaws slack, drenched in sweat. Fort Burtscab sneezed.
Fuck it, Red spat. They're going to press us. I'm going to beat feet to the other end of the court. Burtscab, you complete waste of space. Just throw the ball as far as you can. Everyone else, do whatever it takes to trip those sumbitches up. That's it. Let's get this over with.
They broke without a sound and loped back onto the court where the Globetrotters were already in position, ready to press. Nobody spoke. The only noise in the arena came from the referee below the hoop, nervously dribbling the basketball. He'd never had to actually officiate one of these things and didn't know how to play it. He chose to play it straight, blew his whistle, and handed Burtscab the ball. Immediately, Burtscab cocked back his arm and hurled it as Red broke toward the far hoop 2 seconds before Pokey Joe, who was guarding him, realized what was going on. At first, it seemed as though the ball would catch the rear of the backboard, but it barely cleared and soared just beyond half court, bounced twice before Red could get to it. As the clock clicked from 1 to 0 and Pokey Joe was at Red's back, he unleashed his patented two-handed shot. The buzzer sounded long and loud, and the crowd, the players, the referees drew in deep breaths, watching it spin in an elegant arc through the air and with only the slightest whoosh ball through the hoop. The Washington Generals had won. The arena remained quiet, but for the diminishing bouncing of the basketball. When it stopped, Red began to scream.
I did it! I fucking did it!
He turned to face the others.
I beat you! I'm not a loser! Losers don't win! I won! You are losers! Anytime I want!
He trailed off, fell to his knees, and began to cry. One after another, the children in the audience joined him, wailing in their seats. And then the adults began to boo. They hurled their empty and half-empty sodas and popcorn buckets at the players, who immediately retreated to their respective locker rooms. Except for Red. He stayed on his knees, head in hand, sobbing as garbage rained down and the angry din enveloped him. He wept for a very long time, even after the crowd had grown weary in their anger and dispersed. He wept alone. He wept for his dreams, wept for his dignity, wept for his family, dead, all of them. Wept for his people, wept for how he had let them down. Wept for the hobo whose sad life he had taken. Wept for every shattered man that had sleepwalked through this damnable team, from shit, through shit, to shit. And then he got up. He made his way back to the Super 8 and slept long and hard, dreamless. He woke up, got dressed, and boarded a bus with no air conditioning for the long ride to Tallahassee, where he would lose to the Globetrotters and then reboard the bus to do it again and again for 22 more years.
Washington Generals, I'd like to join your team. I don't play ball, but I do know how to lose and beat me. Washington Generals, you play how I feel. Devoted to a game that isn't real. Washington Generals, Washington Generals, Washington Generals, Washington Generals, Washington Generals.